This is a very natural movement of mind. And we say, you are there, I am here. And we all understand what's meant. So when the Buddha talks about not self, we're not trying to deny or to annihilate the conventional sense of self. What we're doing is actually something else, which takes awareness and real seeing into the process, if you like, of what it is to be conscious and live in the world. So it's about our relationship. It's about our relationship to people, places, and things, and also to ourselves. So our endeavor is to look really carefully. Now, right here I'm going to read you from the text, from one of the middle-length discourses, what the Buddha said. And this is a classic summary, and many of you will know it by heart if you've been around the Dharma for a long time. But understanding it is another thing. So he says, therefore, monks, in this case that's us, any kind of material form, whatever, so that's form is the body or any external object, should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So, any kind of feeling, whatever. So, our feelings, of course, are transient, they're impermanent, they arise and cease, dependent upon conditions. And what we do is we claim them as ours. This is an error. If we can just see and understand that feelings arise and cease, and they fluctuate, and they are insubstantial, we start to know and understand what's meant by the emptiness of self or the emptiness of feelings. I'll go on. Any kind of perception, whatever. So perception is the way we categorize things. So based on our past experience, we've learned to label certain objects as books, glasses case, and so on. So we don't grasp that and say, this is me, this is mine. Any kind of formations, whatever. So any kind of mental formations or thoughts or ideas or views and opinions. So similarly, of course, thoughts are empty of any substantial reality. They don't have substance. They're invisible. They're colourless. We can't find them. We can't touch them. They just come and go at a great rate, especially on retreat, I have heard. So we have hundreds and hundreds and thousands of them a day. And what we tend to do is we think, because I've had that thought, I'm therefore this kind of person. And we draw all kinds of conclusions based on the thoughts that we have. Yet sometimes the mind just throws up rubbish, really. You know, you will have seen this, thinking. We don't have to claim them as ours. And we're not saying that all thoughts are bad, because some thoughts, of course, lead to liberation and some thoughts lead to suffering. We just need to know which are which. But we are asked not to claim them as me and mine. Any kind of consciousness, whatever. So if I say I am aware, oh, I'm so aware today. Oh, my mindfulness practice is brilliant today. Oh, I'm such a hopeless case. I can't meditate to save my life. And so on. So this is, claiming consciousness as self. And so these five things should be seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Now, we can intellectually understand it, but it's actually best understood through our meditation practice. And then we really get it. We really understand that self is a fabrication. It's put together. It's constructed. And when we see that, we realize that self is actually empty of any substantial reality. And this is one of the key teachings of the Buddha Dharma, of the Buddha. So I'm going to try and take you kind of step by step through to emptiness of self. Wish me luck. So we experience the world through the sense doors. We see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think. No argument with that. Yet this process is not really understood in its simplicity because of our habit of dividing experience. So we have the eye that sees the object, but then we construct the seer, the one who is seeing. We have our mind and the thought. And then what we do is we construct the thinker. We have our capacity to feel as human beings and the feeling. And then we construct the one to which this is happening. So what we do is we add the self-construct to all the events as if there is someone that is standing behind all experience. Now, you might wonder why we would bother looking at this. There's a good reason. And the good reason is that this adding on the self, the I, the me, and the my, needs to be examined to see whether it has any actual reality, because clinging to the notion of self, and of course with that comes extraordinary desires and wants in the world, is one of the great causes of conflict on the earth. And as human beings, we really have reached a crisis point. And we need to look and see, is what I'm doing contributing to conflict, or is it contributing to ease and peace? And how can we break free from this habitual way of dividing the world? Because as soon as we have self, of course, we have other. So when we understand our interconnected nature, we heard in one of the inquiries today that when we're just with nature, we can really just be with it, and the sense of self seems to diminish and fade and be light. In Asia, they say like a line drawn on water. So it's just barely there. When we really understand that, we see our interconnectedness, and then, of course, we realize our humanity, the non-difference between self and other. We find a way of living that isn't caught up with our own personal wishes and desires and with self-referencing and making everything about ourselves. And of course, this leads to competitiveness and comparisons and Judgmentality. We also heard that today. So we need to understand this movement of mind. Until we discover a way of acting in the world that isn't bound to greed, hatred, and delusion, so isn't bound to being caught up in wanting mind, the mind that must have, or in any kind of negativity or frustration or hatred. And the mind that's caught in delusion, of course, is the mind that doesn't see clearly, the mind that's confused. And unless we can really look and see and understand what it is that we're doing with our tendency to divide our experience and then all the repercussions that that act, which is seemingly natural and small, has, until we really see that and there's a shift in consciousness, our way of living on this earth, you know, has ended, really. In Australia, for example, we have such dreadful weather events now. This year we've had 3 catastrophic weather events already, the like of which we've not had before. And so we have floods and fires and record temperatures and cyclones where there were never cyclones before and so on. So our very earth is groaning under the weight of our desires, the weight of our wants, the weight of our greed. And so there does need to be a shift. We do need to live in a different way, to live more consciously with more awareness and wakefulness. So coming back to my theme, the term self refers to anything that we cling to or identify with as having distinguishable or fixed qualities. For example, we might reflect on how we are and think, oh, I am anxious. So this is a view of the self. I am an anxious person. Or we might look at ourselves and inflate the ego a little bit and go, oh, I'm so intelligent, I feel so smart today, or I'm really creative today, and so on, the sorts of things we occasionally do. So we either diminish the self or we inflate it, for example, or we draw conclusions because we had a particular feeling in case of anxiety, or in the case of negativity, we can then think that we're, you know, a dreadful person or an unworthy person or an inadequate person and so on. And this self-thinking and the view that we so often have of ourselves as, which is a negative self-view, is so painful and so destructive. And in my work as a psychologist, the feeling of unworthiness or inadequacy was the most common experience that people brought to the session. And I mean, I've not yet met the unworthy person or the worthless person, but it's a view that we sometimes hold about ourselves, and it's so painful. So precisely how we add to our direct experience is coloured by our conditioning based on the past, on memory, and, of course, the particular experiences that we've had in life. It's also coloured with imagination or uncertainty or fear, perhaps. And at its extreme, it can be coloured, consciousness can be coloured by hatred or envy or jealousy or prejudice. So we need to see the afflictions, if you like, the Buddha called them, that visit consciousness, that shape and colour and inform our actions in the world. So So there's countless variations. So what do we do about this? Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of my teachers and one of the great Ajahns of Thailand in the last century, he writes this, and it is so simple and utterly clear. He says, when seeing, just see. When hearing, just hear. When smelling an odor, just smell it. When experiencing a tactile sensation, just experience it. When sensing a mental object, just sense it. Let things stop right there, and insight will function automatically. So, we just see, hear, smell, taste, touch. This was my direction this morning. We just be with life in that way without adding I, me, and my to it, with all of the story of my very tragic life and so on, however we view ourselves. I'm making fun now. Any desire that's in accordance with our liking and disliking is the arising of self. And such a mind is turbulent. So when we are caught up in desires, when we're clinging to something, when we're driven by desire to have, to be, to want, and so on, to achieve, it's an affliction of the mind. So there's a speed with which all of this process happens. And it's not personal, it's just how things unfold. There's contact through the sense doors, there's the feeling tone of the experience. We'll talk about this more tomorrow. And based on liking and disliking, there's attraction and aversion. And then, of course, if we cling, if we get caught in desire, then it comes with the clinging. And then we're already caught in this cycle of becoming. So, must we as human beings be bound to live within the frontiers of our own conditioning? The Buddha says no, as do I. When we pay attention, our natural wisdom lets us see in a way that's not self-centered. I call this non-dual wisdom. It's wisdom that arises when we're not dividing and separating our experience. So, unless we die to the self, to the structures, the theories, the concepts, the desires and beliefs that we hold, we can't really know freedom in the sense that the Buddha talked about it. One of my other teachers was a woman called Vimala Thakur, an Indian woman, and she came to Australia in the 1980s. And she was an extraordinary social activist, as well as being a teacher. She didn't come from a Buddhist tradition, she had a Hindu background, but she spoke in a way that was so liberated and free and extraordinary that I'm going to quote her a couple of times in this talk. She was a wonderful human being. She says, "It is the birthright of every human being to live in a state of unconditional freedom, total freedom, not creating a static point or destination and saying, 'I have become free, I have become liberated.'" She says, "Freedom is a dimension." Now, don't misunderstand, she's not saying you pop into some other strange, unworldly dimension, but rather what she means is freedom is a way of meeting life. It's freedom from the known. It's freedom from the bondage we create ourselves. It's freedom from the center of the me, which was only a contrivance for the convenience of collective living. So, of course, we say you and me, and we all know what we mean. This is a convention. And so we're not denying that convention. So when we really realize the emptiness of self, the insubstantial nature of the five aggregates, as I talked about before, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, with the realization of the emptiness of that, there's a lovely openness and receptivity that comes in an unfragmented way. So we're not dividing and compartmentalizing different parts of ourselves. It's just such a relief. Then the perception isn't born of this division. And in India, they call it aperception, so perception born of the wholeness of life, to meet life fully, wakefully, in an unfragmented way. And the reason for this, of course, the reason that this experience arises is that inquiry, truth, and freedom can never be imprisoned. And therefore, it expresses the sanctity of life, the sacredness of life. It's what I'm saying is really best understood through our meditation experience. So to summarize, the body is empty of selfhood. It's empty of a me that's able to exert control. Because if we could exert control, nobody would ever be sick. For example, I certainly wouldn't be. And I'd make sure you weren't either. So you see, we don't actually have that control because the self is in flux, it's shifting and changing. We like to think we have some kind of chief controller, but that's also just another fabrication and construction of mind. Such an entity, Anaglio, the German monk says, cannot be found in any aspect of experience. The body is empty of a permanent self that is in control. And when I say empty, I don't mean some kind of desolation. It means empty of the problematic ego or empty of selfhood. That's what's meant. And when we understand that, it's the absence of a sense of being closed or bound, or the absence of a sense of owning or possessing. And, of course, it's also experienced as peace and love and freedom. So, what remains if the self is negated? If we really understand not self? Well, what happens is we negate the authority of the past. So, we negate, thank you, the authority of the past. Are we really willing to see what happens if we cease projecting the past onto our sensory experience? The Buddha thinks we should. This is what he says in a text called Single Excellent Night. And I really wish you a single excellent night tonight. Let not a person revive the past or on the future build one's hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. So we're being invited not to be bound to time, past, present, future. We can cling to the present as well as anything else, by the way. Instead, with insight, let one see each presently arisen state. Let one know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. And then the text says, just to scare you a little bit, today the effort must be made, tomorrow death may come, who knows? And then it goes on to say, it's she or he, the peaceful sage, who has had a single excellent night. So Vimala, my Indian woman teacher, says, can the movement of knowledge flow through your body without creating a knower? And the movement of thought without creating a thinker? So this is what I was explaining earlier. She says, are we identifying ourselves with that movement and calling ourselves the I, the me, the mine? So our task is to see our experience, to be with it fully, not to suppress or deny or annihilate the feeling world, to acknowledge it, but not to claim it as me and mine. And the same with our mental thought world. So not claiming it and crystallizing or fixing a self, if you like. Because the more we think about ourselves, which we often do a lot, the more we think about ourselves, the more solid we seem to be. Yet we're doing all of this with these invisible thoughts. We're quite remarkable, really. And then Vimala says this. She says, when the authority of the past is totally negated, that action of negation is one of the most creative actions a human being can be capable of. It appears to be the ending of the authority of the past, but in the very act of negating the authority, the new comes to life. Extraordinary. A new energy, which is not part of inheritance, which is not part of acquisition, conscious acquisition or conscious cultivation, she says, a kind of unconditioned energy. A virgin energy comes to life. The ending of the old and the emergence of the new are not two different events. So let's reflect on that. It is rather extraordinary. And the Buddha points, of course, to us recognizing the conditions of life, but knowing that which is not bound to the conditions, knowing the unconditioned. There's more, but I'll give you a little rest from that. So Vimala goes on to say, when we start to see and get a sense of this creative energy, which is not bound to the conditions and situation of the world, she says, every pore of our being, every fiber of the texture of your personality gets filled with a new clarity, a new light, a new perception and understanding. So that's what you have to look forward to. So, of course, with the cessation of grasping the self, there's the renewal. With the ending of one thing, there's the coming into being of another. And this passage that I was reading is in an article by Vimala called The Art of Dying While Living. So it's a great title. Now to call on Ajahn Chah, one of the other great teachers in the Thai forest tradition. He says, the Buddha made a distinction between ultimate truth and conventional truth. The idea of a self is merely a concept, a convention. I'm Australian, you are Israeli, and so on. Concepts. And he says, ultimately no one exists, only and then using the same kind of elemental terminology that the Buddha used. Ultimately, no one exists, only earth, air, fire, and water that have temporarily combined. So that's how he sees us, or he saw us. So we call the body and each other a person, a self, but ultimately, when we really look for the me, it's fabricated, it's a construct, it's shifting, it's changing, and we can't find it. And Ajahn Chah says, to understand not self, you have to meditate. If you only intellectualize, your head will explode. So there you go. Once you understand not self in your heart, the burden of life will be lifted. Your family life, your work, everything will be much easier. When you see beyond self, you no longer cling to happiness. And when you no longer cling to happiness, you can begin being truly happy. So that's Ajahn Chah. He was a remarkable teacher. I didn't get to meet him, but Ajahn Buddhadasa and Ajahn Chah were good friends. So when we stop looking to the outer for our happiness, a natural happiness begins to emerge through the whole being. How am I going? And here I want to refer to Christopher Titmus. Christopher was a Buddhist monk, and I met him in the Himalayas in 1975. And I spent 6 months of 6 months doing retreat there when I was 23 years old. And he's more recently written a book which is kind of autobiographical, and in it he documents some of the conversations that he actually had with Ajahn Buddhadasa, and there's one in particular that I really like because it's about not self. So Christopher, whose name was Kitty Subo, I know some of you know him, Christopher says to Ajahn Buddhadasa, what do you mean by non-self or not self? And Buddhadasa replies, he says, these teachings differ from other religious teachings. The Buddha didn't speak of a self that goes to heaven or earth, a higher or a lower self, a self that creates its own suffering or its own reality. He taught non-self, non-I, non-my. Nothing has self-existence. And nothing has self-existence, just to explain, because everything, every event and everything relies on previous causes and conditions to come into being. So nothing belongs to a self. All things are non-self. And so Christopher says, but can you give me some examples? What do you really mean by this? And so Buddhadasa replies, in deep meditation, the self loses its substance. Mind and matter dissolve into particles, energy and sensations. This is one expression of non-self. Secondly, he says, every day countless expressions enter consciousness from the past and through the senses about the future. The self did not choose these impressions and contacts, nor choose for them to change. Experiences arose, stayed for a while, and dropped away. This is a different way of looking, isn't it? And Christopher says, so we don't choose suffering. And Buddhadasa replies, and this is really, really important. He says, the self did not choose painful habits, problematic tendencies, and addictions. If the self had the power to repeat such suffering, then the self would have the power to say, suffering, stop, and it would stop. The whole process is non-self or not self. Birth, aging, pain, and death occur. This fourfold process through life does not belong to self, nor did the self invite the process. The self did not ask for suffering and despair to happen to itself. I'm going to read that last sentence again. The self did not ask for suffering and despair to happen to itself. Therefore, we can stop self-blame right now. And so now I'm going to tell you a story. It'll be rather easier. Stories are always, I find, an easier way to kind of understand what's being said in sometimes the complex teachings. And this is a story of a musician I met who very sadly died from stomach cancer. He'd been ill for a couple of years with pain, but he'd hidden this from his adult children and also from his mother. His brother had already died from a brain tumor some years earlier, and he was utterly and totally convinced that he would not die of cancer as well. He thought that it could not happen twice in one family. Sadly, obviously, it can. He believed also that his mother wouldn't cope. She wouldn't cope if another child of hers died. There were just the two sons. Therefore, his denial of his illness was incredibly strong. And by the time I saw him for a counseling session, he was exceedingly ill. His partner, who'd been with him for some years but didn't live with him, brought him to the session. And of course, he met me with great resistance. He announced immediately that he did not believe in counseling. And he was just there to please his partner. So after getting some background information, I met a kind of an impasse because he didn't want to be there. And so then I kind of took the plunge. I said, can you, while living, know death? Can you right now know death? And I saw him kind of move as if he was going to get up and bolt out of the room, but he didn't. He took a breath and stayed. And then what happened was extraordinary. In that very moment, he faced his illness. He faced the reality of what was happening to him. Everything changed. His denial dropped away. Love, tenderness, and openness burst forth. He admitted that he wasn't really good at talking about his feelings except through songwriting and singing. So in the days that followed this brief interaction that I had with him, he told his children that he was ill and dying. His partner moved in with him. He told his mother. He wrote his will. And in his vulnerability and his fragility and openness, he loved beyond measure. He loved so much and was, of course, so deeply loved in return. So the view that he had, I'm not dying, just dropped away. The view that he had, my mother won't cope, dropped away. His mother was stronger than he'd imagined. the view that my children won't know what to do fell away, because obviously the children gathered around and were very wise and loved him and did what they could to make him comfortable, keeping his partner at kind of arm's length also fell away, and his partner moved in with him. So very sadly, he did die a few weeks later, but it was an extraordinary transformation when he simply let go of all the views that he was holding to as self. And of course, in the end, we're also asked to, each of us, to let go of this very body. And so now I want to address another theme, following on from the inquiry, the first inquiry today, and talk a little briefly. I'm going on, I know. Talk a little about Bhikkhu Bodhi. So Bhikkhu Bodhi is a rather famous monk of Jewish ethnicity, and he's been a prolific translator of the Pali suttas of the Buddha. There's lots and lots of big volumes of suttas if anyone's interested in reading them. And more recently, he's written several articles addressing the events of October 7th and the ensuing war and the bombing of Gaza, and also the use of starvation as a weapon of war. So he's written rather wisely, and he says this. He says, first of all, that the misunderstanding about not self is, if there's no self, then nothing matters. I can do whatever I like. However, the Dharma has an ethical foundation of non-harming. So when we see the emptiness of self, we automatically understand love and compassion. So understanding emptiness isn't cold. The word emptiness is unfortunate, because it has associations of barrenness or desolation or depression. But when we really understand the emptiness of self, what we're met with is compassion, love, and kindness. We see our shared humanity. So Bhikkhu Bodhi lists five steps that we as Dharma practitioners can utilize in order to have a wise response to the situation that we all find ourselves in. First one, and I'll go through them fairly quickly. The first one is, he says, it's a matter of internal hygiene. It's a funny expression, but he says it's simply to pause, to sit down and process what we're going through. So instead of allowing our emotional world to overwhelm us, or to be caught up in anger, rage, or negativity or fear as a response to injustice, instead of doing that, we need to really pay attention to our own emotions. Pay attention to them until they dissolve into bare bodily sensations and yield to the innate radiance of the tranquil mind. So when we really pay attention, we start to see that natural radiance of the heart mind, the mind at ease, the mind at peace. So that's step one. The second step, he suggests, is to cultivate the heart and to expand that love and care to embrace all beings. So perhaps to embrace people we're not comfortable with or we don't like, or the strangers in life, and so on. So this is part of our metta practice, our loving kindness meditation practice. So having cultivated the heart, the third step is to find opportunities, he says, to express our moral convictions, to be committed to unity rather than division, to see the non-difference in the other. So this is what I'm pointing to with my talk. So the ending of dividing the world into self and other. And when we really just see that, we see the non-difference, we know immediately the humanity of the other, as we heard this morning, or this afternoon rather. The fourth step is called discernment and reflection. And he says it's to understand how we as human beings have gotten ourselves into this terrible predicament of wars and division, anger and rage, and the destruction of others and of the very planet on which we live. And he also suggests listening to those who are wise in the world, so listening to the greatest thinkers, so that we might emerge from this very difficult point that we seem to be caught in. And then he says, the possible fifth step is to strategize and organize. So the monk that I always thought was incredibly conservative has become quite an activist, I think. So to summarize, it's to find a way of being and meeting the world that isn't bound up with I, me, and my. And when we do that, we realize our interconnected nature. We realize then that the suffering of one is the suffering of all. And then we allow our wisdom, born of non-dual understanding, to inform our actions and find a way of expressing that in the world. So let's just sit together quietly.